So good morning, everybody. It looks like the trickle of new participants is slowing down here. So I think we'll go ahead and get started as to be respectful of everybody's time. Welcome to the 2024 year-end tax update presented by the man we all know and love, Mark Verity, our Director of Tax and Financial Planning, as well as the tax advisor to many of our clients. A couple of housekeeping items before we start. Very briefly, we do have the chat feature open for any questions that anybody might have during the presentation. The chat is confidential. Nobody can see your question or your name except for those of us that are giving the call. So that would be Mark and myself. To the extent we have time at the end, we'll answer those questions. Mark's got a lot to cover here, so we may not have time at the end. But if we don't, we will reach out to you and let you know the answer to those questions, as well as post them along with the replay of this presentation on our website. And directions to access that will be forthcoming. So with that, like I said, Mark's got a lot to get through, so I'm going to turn it over to him.
Great. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, everyone, for taking your time out of your day to join us for this 2024 year-end tax update. As Michael mentioned, we'll spend about 45 minutes together today. There is a lot to cover, and in the interest of time, I'll be hitting some of the highlights throughout the slides, and hopefully you find some things that will be helpful, and we'll try to focus on things that are most impactful to the largest number of our clients. Obviously, everyone's situation is different, and you'll hear me say throughout the presentation to touch base with myself, your CPA or tax preparer, or your wealth management advisor. If you have specific questions to your situation, we can help you address those at that time. As Michael mentioned, I'm the Director of Tax and Financial Planning here with the firm. Joined the firm in 2013, and so I've been head of that department since 2013. And a little bit about our team. We have a dedicated team of CPAs and certified financial planner professionals on our team, providing tax return preparation, tax planning and consulting, and financial planning services to those GOTC and GIB wealth management clients who engage us to do so. And whether it's a comprehensive financial plan or an annual income tax return preparation, or even just some one-off questions that you may have on a tax-related topic or financial planning related questions, we work with you and your wealth management advisor to help provide guidance to your individual situation. So from there, we'll dive right in here. By way of an agenda, again, we'll touch on primarily individual income tax, the various tax acts that affect most of us as we prepare our tax returns, and then touch on some planning strategies for 2024, as well as really beyond 2024 into 2025, because we typically take more of a multi-year approach as it relates to figuring out what's most tax efficient for our clients. And then if we have time at the end, we'll also touch on estate and trust income tax, as well as gift tax items, and some strategies to help minimize taxes and to make sure that your estate plan and estate planning documents are set up in a manner in which you intended with all of the tax law changes that have occurred over the past few years. And then a brief summary at the end. And as Michael mentioned, if we have the opportunity to address some of your questions, we'll tack those on. If not, we'll certainly get to those questions after this call. I will say also, for those of you who may not be on the actual Zoom meeting and seeing this live on screen, I'm sharing my screen slides, but if you downloaded the PDF and are flipping through that, I'll try to be mindful of letting you know when I go to the next slide, but I apologize in advance if I move kind of quickly or neglect to mention that as I'm going through. First, getting into individual taxes, on the next slide here for individual income tax is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, or TCJA. This is now pretty familiar. It's been part of our tax law since 2018, and it's effective through 2025. And essentially, just to summarize, it lowered income tax rates across various income tax brackets. It maintained the preferential qualified dividends and long-term capital gains tax rates at 0%, 15%, and 20%. There's also a 20% qualified business income deduction for certain pass-through entities. There was also the doubling of the standard deduction. So a lot of folks are just taking a standard deduction now versus itemizing, and we'll get into that more as we go through the presentation. Now that the election has passed and we have the election results, we've had a lot of questions around whether the TCJA was going to be extended beyond tax year 2025. With the election of Donald Trump as the 47th president of the United States, and now with the Republican majority in the Senate and now in the House as well, I don't have a crystal ball, but my opinion is that it is highly likely that a lot of the provisions within the TCJA will be extended beyond 2025, along with possibly some other tax cuts that President-elect Trump mentioned out on the campaign trail. So we'll certainly stay on top of that and bring you up to date on anything that we learn as it relates to tax planning for 26 and beyond. To this point, we've really been focused on anticipating the expiration of this tax act at the end of next year and planning for that accordingly in terms of income tax planning and whether you should take certain deductions or accelerate or defer income. Now those types of concerns have been assuaged a little bit, but we can only go with the information we have at hand right now, which is that it is only effective through next year, 2025, which I can't believe I'm saying next year is 2025. Going on to the next slide, we have the next few slides will have the ordinary income tax rates and the standard deduction amounts for individuals, whether you're filing single, married filing jointly, head of household, if you're a single parent or have a dependent, whether it's your child or another dependent relative in your household, and the various taxable income amounts there, you can see where you would fall in terms of your ordinary income tax brackets. At this point, the IRS has announced most of the 2025 inflation adjustment amounts for these rates and deductions, so I've included those in these slides as well for future reference. So on the next slide, we have the 2025 ordinary income rates, as well as the next slide, 2024 long-term capital gains tax rates, again, 0, 15%, 20%. And the tax bracket into which you fall for long-term cap gains rates depends on your overall taxable income and what your range is. And you can see the amounts there on the screen for 2024. And then the next screen here, again, 2025, you can see a slight increase in the taxable income numbers under each respective bracket there. The next slide, again, the standard deduction amounts were doubled with the TCJA. So a lot of our clients are taking the standard deduction versus itemizing, but there are still opportunities to itemize where it's appropriate for your situation. Here are the 2024 standard deduction amounts. The amounts have increased slightly for 2025, which are on this next slide here. So you have those handy for future reference. So as you can see, let me go back one to the 2024. If you look at the married filing jointly, $29,200. If you're both over age 65, that's another $3,100 or so, $3,200 on top of that. So it's a really, you know, significant $32,300 would be your total standard deduction. So pretty good size deduction. A lot of clients are using that. And in some ways it simplifies tax preparation. However, if you have state and local income taxes, mortgage interest, charitable contributions, it may still be worth taking the time to go through and compiling those itemized deductions and see if that's going to be an added benefit for you. So the next slide, we'll get into the allowable itemized deductions. The big changes here, and again, this is should be familiar at this point, but to highlight the state and local tax deduction, the second bullet point here is limited to $10,000, which was a significant change for folks who are in higher taxed states. And that's something else that was touted on the campaign trail, President-elect Trump saying that he may do away with this limitation after 2025, so we'll see what happens there. And then no miscellaneous itemized deductions at the bottom bullet point there. Tax prep fees, investment management fees, or unreimbursed employee expenses are no longer deductible. So that's something to keep in mind. Charitable contribution and medical expenses have AGI limitations, which I'll mention a lot throughout the presentation. Adjusted gross income, which is essentially all of your income amounts before your deductions, and a lot of deductibility of certain items, as well as what we'll talk about a little bit later, some tax triggers are some surtaxes and additional costs that you could unintentionally run into simply because of your income level. So we want to touch on those and be sensitive to those as we're planning for 2024 and beyond. The net investment income tax on this next slide is essentially a 3.8% surtax on your net investment income, which includes these items on the left of your screen: interest, dividends, capital gains, rents, etc. And it's really a surtax on the lesser of these amounts in your income, or to the extent that your income exceeds modified adjusted gross income amounts on the right-hand side of your slide there. The next page actually has an example of the calculation for that. And again, it's something to keep in mind if you're running up against some of these income amounts, because you could have long-term capital gains and qualified dividends that you think are being taxed at 15%, let's say, going back to the previous slide for the rates that were on there. but because of your overall income, it could actually be subject to 15% plus 3.8%. So something to keep in mind as you're looking at components of income as well as your amount of income to get to that AGI number that could subject you to those triggers. Now we'll get the next slide. We'll get into the SECURE Act. It was put into effect in 2019. It really affects taxpayers in 2020 and beyond. And the big highlights here, just as reminders, there's no age limit on contributing to your IRAs. So it used to be that once you were 7 and a half, you didn't contribute to your IRAs anymore. If you're still working, you can still contribute to your IRAs. It changed the required minimum distribution age to 72. And now with the SECURE 2.0, it's now 73. And it will be 75 in beginning, I believe, in 2033. We'll get on another slide here in a moment. The big thing also was the stretch IRA distributions. That has been limited. We'll get into more detail on that for certain beneficiaries who have inherited IRAs. On the next slide for beneficiary distributions, the most common one we have is a surviving spouse inheriting an inherited IRA. They are able to treat the IRA as their own and take distributions from that inherited IRA over their own life expectancy. The non-spouse beneficiaries are folks that are now subject to the 10-year rule if they've inherited an IRA in 2020 and later. And on the next slide, we'll get into the proposed versus final regulations. When this came out, a lot of folks interpreted it as, well, yes, I need to take this money out over 10 years, but do I need to take distributions every year in years 1 through 9, or can I just take it all in year 10? And for a lot of folks, it still made sense to take it in year 1 through year 9 to smooth out that income stream and the taxable income effect over those years versus waiting until year 10, depending on the size of the IRA, could be a significant spike to your taxable income as well as your tax liability. So it may have made sense to take some each year anyway, and again, consult your tax advisor in your own particular situation. But finally, after a few years of this varied interpretation, they have finally issued regulations saying, number one, confirming, yes, non-spouse beneficiaries must fully liquidate their inherited IRA within 10 years, so the 10-year rule. But on the next slide, they also laid out whether you need to take distributions each year between years 1 and 10, or if you can wait till year 10 to take the money out, if you have that flexibility. So for non-spouse beneficiaries who inherited IRAs from someone who passed away before their required beginning date, so before they had to start taking RMDs, then only the 10-year rule applies. So if you inherited an IRA from someone who was not of RMD age, didn't have to start taking distributions, then you can wait until year 10. You're not required to take amounts out before that. Now, again, you may want to, it may make sense to take some out each year, but you don't have to. But if someone passed away after their required beginning date, so if they have been taking RMDs, now the 10-year rule applies to those non-spouse beneficiaries, and you have to take RMDs years 1 through 9 and have it fully liquidated by the end of the 10th year following the original account owner's passing. But the amount of the annual RMDs each year can be the longer of the non-spouse beneficiary's life expectancy or the decedent's remaining life expectancy based on the IRS tables. So you do have to take RMDs from that inherited IRA if the person who passed away was already taking their RMDs, but the amounts may depend on your life expectancy tables, and you may get to year 10 and there may still be a significant amount there to liquidate in year 10. So again, may want to smooth that out over the 10-year period versus having a larger spike in your income down the road. The next slide here, eligible designated beneficiaries. The folks that I was referring to before, the non-spouse beneficiaries, those are considered non-eligible designated beneficiaries. A designated beneficiary being someone who is designated on the IRA forms. When you fill out your IRA forms, who do you want your IRA to go to? Your spouse, your children, grandchildren, a trust, a charity, etc. And if you're a non-eligible designated beneficiary, then you're not part of this group on this slide. Otherwise, you're an eligible designated beneficiary, the most common being the surviving spouse, and you're able to take the inherited IRA distributions over a longer period of time. So you're able to stretch out beyond the 10-year rule, potentially over your life expectancy. I will point out, though, on the second sub-bullet point here, the children who have not reached age of majority, age 21, in the case of this law, they have to take distributions based on the life expectancy tables, which could be a, would likely be a very small amount based on their age. However, when they reach age of majority, when they reach 21, they have to switch to the 10-year rule. So now they have to switch to the 10-year rule and make sure that they fully liquidated the inherited IRA essentially by the time they turn 31, so 10 years out from age 21. So I'll try to keep the commentary to myself, but it's just another one of those things that just seems to get more complicated than it needs to be. But certainly consult your tax advisor if you run into this situation, just to make sure you don't run afoul of any rules. One thing I'll also mention is that the IRS over the last few years, because of the confusion surrounding do I take RMDs, how much are they have waived any penalties for not taking the RMD. And so even through 2024, if you don't take your inherited IRA RMD for an inherited IRA that you inherited in 2020 or beyond, there won't be a penalty, but the penalties will not be waived starting in 2025. And again, at the bottom here, folks that inherited IRAs prior to 2020 should also be exempt because the rules came into effect for IRAs inherited after December 31st, 2019. The next slide here, the Secure Act 2.0, there were a lot of provisions within this. The main ones I'll touch on is that they made changes to try to improve retirement saving opportunities, including automatic 401k plan enrollment and increasing the RMD age to 73. So on the next slide here, you can see the new RMD rules, age 73 beginning back in January 2023, and then in January 2033 for folks that are age 75, that will be your, the RMD age when you need to start taking your required minimum distributions. They also reduced the excise penalty for failure to take the RMD. And so you can see that information there on the screen. They talk about if the IRS mentioned that if you fail to take the RMD and you corrected that in a quote timely manner, that's defined in the act. It's still kind of vague. I think it really is a case by case scenario. If you realize that you didn't take your RMD and you took it as quickly as possible, once you realize you didn't take it, the excise tax could be reduced to 10%. So that, again, that's a penalty on the amount that you were supposed to take out that you didn't. Secure Act 2.0 on the next slide, the retirement catch-up contributions. For years, there's been a catch-up contribution for folks who contribute to IRAs and to retirement plans. If you're aged 50 and older, there is an additional amount that you're able to contribute to, for your example, your traditional IRA, $1,000 on top of the $7,000 or $7,500 contribution. And then now, though, they are adjusting that number for inflation going forward versus keeping it stagnant and then making jumps in after multiple years of keeping it the same amount. Coincidentally, it's still at $1,000 right now, but that's going to be adjusted for inflation or revisited each year. And if there is an inflation adjustment that it warrants an increase in the catch-up contribution, then the IRS will make those changes. The one thing I'll point out is in 2025, so next year, there will also be an increased catch-up contribution amount. So in addition to the age 50 and older contribution, if you are between the ages of 60 and 63 starting next year, then you will have an additional amount that will be added to your contribution limit. But the total contribution limit for folks that are aged 60 to 63 starting next year can be up to $34,750. One thing that they also included in this was those catch-up contributions would have to be Roth contributions. Again, adding a little undue complexity, in my opinion, to the tax law. However, there has been granted a two-year delay in the effective date of having to treat those as Roth catch-up contributions. There were some lobbying from plan sponsors and custodians with having to make changes to plan documents and update systems that it was just not able to be done as quickly as this was enacted. So that's been delayed until 2026, effectively. At that point, that could change. We'll keep an eye on that as well. But for now, starting in 2025, if you're between the ages of 60 and 63, that additional catch-up contribution can be pre-tax if you're contributing pre-tax, or it can be Roth. It can be one or the other versus being mandatory to be Roth. But again, we'll keep an eye on that. The next piece of legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, was passed in 2022. There were a lot of provisions within this act. The one we're going to focus on the most for this call today is the clean energy credits that are in effect, started in 2023, but they're still in effect for several more years. I'll get into that in the next couple of slides. The next one here, the energy efficient home improvement credit. This is a credit that's equal to 30% of the costs of certain qualifying energy efficient home improvements for a maximum of $1,200. And this includes the labor, materials, installation, all of that. It qualifies for the credit. And there's some of the types of improvements are listed on the screen there. There's also a $2,000 maximum for qualifying heat pumps and water heaters on the next slide. And these are annual maximums, by the way. Previously to the Inflation Reduction Act, a lot of the tax credits that were for energy efficiency improvements were one-time credits, lifetime limits. So if you used up the $1,200 in 2024, let's say next year, if you made additional improvements, you wouldn't have access to any additional credits because you took the credit in this year. Now, these are annual maximums. So if you had eligible credits this year and you take the $1,200 credit against your taxes, which is a dollar for dollar credit, by the way, against your tax liability, you would be able to do the same thing next year if you had qualifying purchases. So it's a significant change to the credits if you're thinking about making these types of changes and adding these types of improvements to your home. And after 2024, no credit will be allowed unless the manufacturer creates a product ID number and the taxpayer includes that number on their tax return. So it would be interesting to see what is generated between the IRS and manufacturers to make sure that product ID numbers are available for all of us to be able to use on our tax return and what the forms are going to look like in 2025 to make sure we include that information and get the credits that we deserve for making these types of purchases. The next slide, the Residential Clean Energy Property Credit. This is primarily related to the installation, labor, and materials, again, of solar panels, solar water heaters, et cetera. And currently, 2024 through 2032, it's going to be 30% of the cost. And there's no overall dollar limit. There's one exception for some fuel cell property there on the bottom. But generally speaking, there are no overall dollar limits for that amount. The amount of the credit as a percentage of the cost decreases to 26% in 2033 and 22% in 2034. The next slide here, clean vehicle credit. This is for purchasing an electric vehicle. They added pre-owned vehicle credits. It used to be just for brand new vehicles. Now they're eligible for previously owned clean vehicles as well as qualified commercial vehicles. And you can see the amounts on there as well. There are several limitations that apply based on the retail price, based on adjusted gross income. So you want to check the fine print on that and make sure that the vehicle that you're purchasing is eligible for these credits. I think there's also, starting in January of 2024, this year, dealers must submit information to the IRS through the IRS Energy Credits online. And so this will help buyers have the information they need because the dealer is supposed to provide a buyer with a copy of the IRS's approval of this dealer submission that the vehicle qualifies for the clean vehicle credit. So it sounds like this is making it a lot easier for taxpayers when they do buy a vehicle to have the documentation they need to support the credit on their tax return. Now we'll get into the planning strategies for 2024. And as I mentioned earlier, getting even into 2025 to help reduce your tax liability. This next slide, current tax law strategy considerations regarding deferral, pre-tax deferrals, maximizing your retirement plan, your 401k, your 403b, as well as your IRA contributions, whether that's pre-tax or Roth, actually, is a tax-efficient strategy if you're still working, especially if you're in your peak earning years or near peak earning years. You want to maximize the deferral of your retirement plan contributions so that you avoid being taxed on those monies at your current tax rate. Let's say you're in the 24 or 35 or even 37% rate bracket because you're currently working and you're in your high earning years. And when you retire, those wages are no longer part of your overall income and you presumably will be at a lower income level and a lower tax bracket, then taking distributions from what would probably be in a rollover IRA at that point, if you roll over your retirement plan to an IRA and start taking distributions and having those monies taxed in the lower tax bracket. Also, SEP IRA contributions, particularly if you're self-employed, would also maximize your pre-tax contributions there. And you can see the amounts that the contribution limits on the slide here. On the next slide, Roth IRA conversions and or traditional IRA distributions, whether you take distributions from your IRA and incur taxes now before you have to at age 73 for your RMDs, or as we talked about earlier, inherited IRAs, taking money out between years 1 and 9, even if you don't have to, that might be a more tax efficient strategy for you under the current tax rates, again, before the TCJA sunsets or expires at the end of 2025. Again, we'll keep an eye on that, see if that gets extended. But there are also things, in addition to your tax bracket, you want to consider, you know, your cash flow, the timing of other sources of income, your Social Security, having to take money out of your IRA for RMDs, other assets that you have and other taxable income sources to make sure that you're not adding, as I talked about those tax triggers earlier, not unknowingly running into those tax triggers from the net investment income tax or even Medicare premiums, the impact on those, as I mentioned at the bottom of this slide, the bullet point there, if your Medicare premiums amounts are impacted by your adjusted gross income because the Social Security Administration reviews your tax return each year. And based on what your adjusted gross income is, your Medicare premiums could be increased. They call an income-related Medicare adjustment amount. And so you want to keep an eye on that. Again, it may be something that's unavoidable based on your income and not the only reason why you would be making the decision to take distributions from your IRA, but something to just be mindful of instead of being blindsided by an increase in your premiums or being subject to the net investment income tax. On the next slide, long-term capital gains. Realizing long-term capital gains at the 0% rate or the 15% rate may make sense in case that is something that's not extended beyond next year. Harvesting losses when appropriate. Here at Godsey and Gibb, our tax and financial planning team works with you and with your wealth management advisor, as well as with the portfolio management group here, to determine whether harvesting losses make sense. Annually, as a firm, we look at whether there is, you know, synergies between tax loss harvesting from a tax standpoint, but more importantly, from an investment management standpoint. We have the benefit of being essentially a CPA firm within a wealth management firm. So yes, on one hand, we want to look at minimizing your taxes, but we don't look at those in a vacuum. We look at those as it relates to your overall investment management objectives, as well as the firm's investment strategy. And if it makes sense to harvest losses, then certainly that would be appropriate. But we do not want the tax tail to wag the dog, if you will. We wouldn't want that to be the sole decision as it relates to managing your assets and your investments. But we certainly consider taxes in within the decision-making process. Itemized deductions versus a standard deduction. Again, standard deduction is more prevalent, but it may be worthwhile to bunch your itemized deductions for the additional tax benefit. A couple of areas in which we recommend this is with charitable contributions and medical expenses. By the way, we've actually talked about this in some of our newsletters. We have a Q&A section within the Wealth Management Dispatch, and those are available online on our website, godseyandgibb.com. I believe you click on the education tab on the homepage. That'll take you to some of our prior newsletters, and so I highly recommend perusing those at your convenience if you haven't seen those before. But being able to bunch your charitable contribution in alternate years can be beneficial to you if it gets you over that standard deduction hurdle. Going back to the married filing joint numbers I mentioned earlier, $32,300 if you're married filing jointly and you're both over age 65. So if your charitable contributions, let's just make an example. If you give $25,000 per year to your alma mater or your other preferred charity, then if that's your only itemized deduction, taking the standard deduction makes more sense, right? Instead of $25,000, you're taking $32,300. However, if you decide to bunch the charitable contributions in 2024, as an example, let's say instead of giving $25,000 this year and $25,000 next year, I'll give $50,000 in 2024. That way I get the added benefit of a $50,000 deduction versus $32,000. Next year, I will take the standard deduction of $32,000, or you know, if it's, you know, the amounts that are adjusted above that for inflation next year. And then in 2026, I'll do another bunching strategy for charitable contributions. So that's one example of how that could be beneficial. Also, donating appreciated stock, it doesn't necessarily have to be cash. If you donate appreciated stock, either directly or using a donor advised fund, you get the tax benefit of the fair market value of the stock that you gift on the date that you gifted it, and you avoid the capital gains taxes. If you had sold the stock and had a very low basis and have a large capital gain, you pay taxes on that gain and then gift to charity. This way you're gifting straight to charity the stock and having that fair market value tax deduction and avoid the capital gains tax. The donor advised fund also is a way to accomplish that as well, but there's added flexibility there because you're able to make that large donation in 1 year and you have control over how those funds are paid out to various charities over multiple years going forward versus giving directly to charity in the current year. You're able to get the deduction in the current year, but have opportunities to make distributions from that donor advised fund in future years. And you can speak with us or your wealth management advisor knows a lot more about donor advised fund if it's something that you think would be beneficial for you and your tax situation, as well as for your philanthropic goals. On the next slide, the bunching medical expenses, as I mentioned, there's the 7.5% of AGI hurdle that needs to be cleared before you can start deducting medical expenses. So it's not a very prevalent deduction that we see with our clients. However, if you know that you have, in addition to your co-pays, your prescription drugs, your long-term care premiums, Medicare premiums, if you know that you're going to have a significant surgery, elective surgery, let's say, or you're going to enter an assisted living facility or an independent living facility, and it has a significant entrance fee, a portion of which could be considered medical expenses because the facility typically gets an annual letter from their auditors saying that a certain portion or percentage of that entrance fee could be considered a deductible medical expense. Those types of significant cost outlays for you, if they can be consolidated or bunched into 1 year, may get you over that 7.5% hurdle and be beneficial from a tax perspective. If you know it's something that you're going to incur at some point, if there's an ability to time those expenditures, that can be beneficial from a tax perspective as well. And then finally, at the bottom, evaluate the timing and of transactions eligible for the tax credits. As we saw with the Inflation Reduction Act, there's a lot of tax credits that are available, and looking at whether you're making energy efficient improvements to your home or solar panels or clean vehicles, determine which year may be best for you to make those purchases from not only from a personal perspective, but from a tax perspective. Particularly, let's say you have a high income year, you know that 2024 has been a high income year, or maybe next year is going, you know that there's significant income that's coming in next year, and you want to have potentially have a credit to offset some of that tax liability and defer such purchases into 2025, as an example. The next slide for qualified charitable distributions is another way to meet your charitable goals, but also exclude that from your taxable income. You must be over age 70.5 on the date that these QCDs are made. The funds must go directly to the charity from your IRA. Now, you can have them make out a check to you payable to the charity if it's something that you wanted to deliver personally. Otherwise, you can instruct your IRA custodian to send funds directly to charity, and those amounts are not included in your taxable income. And this can be done up to $100,000 per year, and it's counted towards your RMD. So if you're someone who has required minimum distributions and you gift to charity anyway, it may make more sense to have the funds diverted as a QCD out of your IRA versus taking the cash out as an RMD, which is taxable to you. But also, I want to keep in mind that the onus is on the taxpayer. It is on you and the tax preparer to make sure the tax preparer knows that you made these QCDs, because when you get the form 1099-R at the end of the year, let's say you get one from Schwab that shows the gross distributions that you took out of your IRA, there's a box for taxable distributions, and typically that number is the same as the gross distributions, and there's a box that's checked that says the taxable amount was not calculated, because the onus is on you to say to your tax preparer, and I'm just going to make up a number, let's say your distributions were $100,000. You had an RMD of $100,000, and you said, I'm going to give $50,000 of that to charity as a QCD. The 1099-R is going to say $100,000 in both the gross box and the taxable distribution box. And you need to let the tax preparer know, hey, I gave $50,000 directly to charity as QCDs. Here's the information. And if we're preparing your taxes, we would reduce the taxable portion of your gross distributions by those QCDs, so that in this example, you're taxed on the $50,000 that you actually took out of your RMD for your own use, and not the $50,000 that is given to charity. And again, I know this is repetitive, but the AGI is also reduced And that can also help you in terms of your Medicare premiums and being subject to the 3.8% net investment income tax, because you've kept this gross taxable distribution, some or all of that, out of your taxable income and out of your gross income because you gave it to charity directly. And finally, there's management fees. As I mentioned earlier, the itemized deductions are not available for tax prep fees, investment management fees, unreimbursed employee expenses. So we used to recommend having all management fees taken out of your taxable account, because then you could deduct it on your tax return. Since that's no longer the case and hasn't been for a few years now, we recommend having your IRA management fees deducted and paid from your IRA. So essentially you're getting a tax-free distribution from your IRA to cover those management fees. Now, only the fees related to that specific IRA can be paid out of the IRA. You cannot pay another account's management fees out of the IRA. So I just want to clarify that. Finally, as far as this is getting close to the end of the individual tax, I know we're running up on time here, so I'll try to move a little bit quicker. This time of year, it's important to look at what your tax liability is looking like for this year, because the IRS wants its money throughout the year, whether it's withholdings from your paycheck if you're still working, whether it's IRA withholdings from your RMDs, or making quarterly estimated tax payments. So this time of year, it's a good time to look and kind of square up where you are. If you had a more significant income year this year than you had previously estimated, you may want to bump up your withholding for your remaining distributions from your IRA, for example, or from your paycheck. Alternatively, if you front-loaded, so to speak, your withholdings and tax payments earlier in the year because you expected your income to be higher and it was lower than you expected, you may be able to forego the next payment. But again, that's something you want to go over with your wealth management advisor, your tax preparer, your tax advisor, and see to address your specific situation. And there's also an IRS withholding estimator for folks who are still working. Put the link at the bottom of the slide here, but you can also Google IRS withholding estimator and the results should take you to the IRS website and to the link, so you can put in information about your pay and your whether you're married, whether you have children, and it can help you determine what your withholding should be, and you can give that to your payroll department to adjust your withholdings amounts. The next slide, this is the last part in doing with individuals, and it's not a 2024 tax planning strategy per se, but I would be remiss if we did not address and speak to our clients who were heavily impacted by Hurricanes Debbie, Helene, and Milton, particularly in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. The IRS has provided some tax relief to the folks in those areas, and you can see the various deadlines and periods of time that are covered on the screen, but essentially giving until May 1st of 2025 to make certain tax payments and file certain tax returns that are due, again, during those periods. And this could be either a statewide relief or specific county, so you have to check and see if any of these apply to you. I'm going to go to a couple of my notes here just because there's some fine print related to this. And again, want to see if you qualify for these. But even though these are available, I would guard against it, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. And this is really for two reasons. One, keeping up with regularly scheduled tax payments and regularly scheduled tax return filings by the normal deadlines is already complicated enough. Trying to determine if you're qualified for this extended relief or postponements to May 1st just makes it a little more complicated. But also, you must note on the payments and on the tax returns that you file that you qualify for this relief. So there's some more administration around that. And I personally wouldn't want to rely on the IRS to properly treat the payments that you make and the tax return filings that you do, even if you paid them later than they were regularly scheduled, but you did it by May 1st. Just from experience, especially during COVID, I envision a barrage of IRS notices saying that you have penalties and interest assessed for making late payments or filing returns late, only to have to go back to the IRS and explain to them, I qualified for this relief. So therefore, I did make my payments on time because it was before May 1st. I'm not saying you can't do it. And by all means, this was put in place, and I know we're running up on time here, another couple minutes, if you don't mind. Obviously, it's just certainly something that's available to you. It was put in place for those folks who were displaced and just from a practical perspective are not able to meet the deadlines for tax payments or certain tax filings. And so by all means, our thoughts and and hearts are with you all that have endured all of these devastating storms and are still recovering from them. But from a practical perspective, for those of you just being candid, for those of you who can meet the regularly scheduled deadlines, we highly recommend it. So I know we're pretty much out of time here. I only want to mention, if I can have just 5 minutes, a couple things on the estate and trust side and gift side. The rates, I wanted to mention the tax rates that are on here. They're much more compressed than the individual. If you go to the estate and trust tax law overview slide, you reach the 37% tax bracket at $15,200. So one planning tip is that if you have beneficiaries that you know are in lower tax brackets and the trust document allows for distributions to those beneficiaries, it may make sense to distribute some of that income out to the beneficiaries so that the taxes on the income and the trusts are taxed at the beneficiary's individual level than the trust level. And finally, the estate and gift tax lifetime exemption amounts are adjusted each year. I wanted to include those in the slides. This year is $13.61 million per individual, $27.22 if you're considering a married couple and their combined estates. It's almost $14 million next year, almost $28 million for couples. The annual gift tax exclusion amount is $18,000 per recipient. That's doubled to $36,000 if you're married and you split the gift. It'll be $19,000 in 2025, as we see on the next slide here. Education savings plans, you can gift up to 5 years in 1 year. If you have grandchildren or children that are going to college, you can gift up to $90,000 or $95,000 next year. Treat it as a gift that has been elected on a gift tax return as having been made over 5 years, so that you don't use up any of your lifetime exclusion amount, but you are able to make a sizable gift and have a possible state tax deduction in the year that you make the gift. And then finally, the deceased spouse's unused exemption amount. I promise this is the last point I'll make here. This is something that is very important and can save clients who have taxable estates potentially literally millions of dollars. If a spouse passes away and they don't use up their exemption amount, whatever remaining exemption amount that's available up to that $13.61 million in 2024, and again, almost $14 million next year, is portable. You have to file an estate tax return, a 706 return, electing to port this amount over to the surviving spouse. So you could essentially double the surviving spouse lifetime exemption and have them avoid estate taxes as well. So I'm going to wrap it up there. We're about a few minutes over. Revisit your estate planning documents, your wills, your trusts, your powers of attorney, medical directives, just to get with your estate attorney and ensure that your estate plans accurately reflect tax law, because with all the changes that have been happening over the years, particularly if you move states, you want to make sure that your estate plan is updated for the state of domicile and that they reflect your intentions under the current law. So I will leave it there. Everything else here was just summary points to reiterate what we had talked about. That will be online, available for future reference. I will stop there. I will turn it back over to Michael if there's anything that we need to chat about beyond this. Again, if you have questions, we can address that after the call, and we'll have that up online. The transcript and the replay of this will be available in the next couple of weeks online, so you'll be able to watch this if you didn't get a chance to watch it today, or someone you know that's a client that wants to watch it, they can watch it and have the files also for future reference. So I thank you so much for taking your time to be with us today. I know it was a lot of information covered in a short amount of time, but hopefully some of it was beneficial. And again, reach out to your wealth management advisor, your CPA or tax preparer, if you have any questions and to discuss your particular situation.
Thank you, Mark. Again, that was a lot of information, and Mark actually, he took care of all the information that I was going to share at the end. But thank you again, everybody, for giving us your time. Hopefully you got some value out of this, and we're looking forward to hearing from each of you in the future. Thank you so much.